Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tough economic headlines all over this week. Inflation churning up. Consumer confidence headed south. Growth at a near halt. The dollar swooning. The economic situation has become distinctly less favorable, says Fed Chief Ben Bernanke now. So we see. But where next and how low could this go? This hour, On Point, rumors of recession or worse, and where our deeply unsettled economy is heading. We'll hear in this hour from former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, from Newsweek's Robert Samuelson, and we'll talk with David Keene of the American Conservative Union about William F. Buckley Jr., who died yesterday at 82, and his impact on American conservatism. But first, joining me from New York is Howard Davidowitz, retail analyst and chairman of Davidowitz & Associates, to look at the impact of mounting inflation on the economy at storefront level. Mr. Davidowitz, thanks very much for being here. What do you see out there, sir?
Well, I see a complete mess. I see the consumer has never had more debt, is having a tremendous tax increase because of massive inflation on, you know, on energy and food. Average consumer's walking around with 5% inflation. It's effectively a tremendous tax increase. The housing, we've got the worst housing crisis since the Great Depression. Subprime loans and other loans, and people get buying homes for nothing down, 40% of them undocumented. Things a complete mess. The consumers had 24 months of negative savings, the longest period since the Great Depression. So we have negative savings. The consumer is falling behind on their credit card payments, on their car loan payments, on student loan payments. If you look at the delinquency rates, 30, 60, 90 days old from the credit card companies, they're up 25%. The consumer is not paying their credit card loans. In addition to all of this, we've got a collapsed banking system, so the banks are pulling in their horns. Nobody runs faster than a scared banker. They're pulling back credit. It's a confluence of terrible events, all brought about by the biggest debt in the nation, the United States. George Bush has borrowed more money, of course, than all the prior presidents put together. And his latest stimulus package will borrow, of course, that from China, too. And we'll be dropping checks out of helicopters. So basically, we stand in the middle of a complete mess. I see no logical solution. Ben Bernanke's cutting the interest rates every day. Inflation is going through the roof. The dollar, of course, is utterly collapsing, and I think it'll be under threat as the world's reserve currency. And that's where we are.
Wow. You talk to retailers all the time. What are you hearing from them? What's happening in the storefront world?
Well, when we look at the storefront world, what we're going to see is 6,000 to 7,000 closed stores this year. And, of course, you see companies like Levitt's just filed bankruptcy. They're going out of business. Bombay is closing all their stores. CompUSA is closing all their stores. Charming is closing all their stores. Fortune House just went bankrupt. Sharper Image just went bankrupt. Lillian Vernon just went bankrupt.
Oh,
Pep Boys closing stores. We have winners and losers, but we've never had more closed stores. The consumer, because of the list of things I rattled off, has never been weaker. I mean, Walmart's got 150 million customers. The CEO, Lee Scott, has said 20% of them don't have bank accounts. They've got to go to a check cashing service. By the way, translated, that's 30 million people.
The Fed is saying later this year we should come out of this. We should be okay. We won't even go into recession.
Well, they've said a lot of things. Let's go back over what they said. First of all, 6 months ago, they were assuring us the economy was in excellent shape and this housing crisis was just a blip. That was their position 6 months ago. It was not my position. It was their position.
Yep.
I think they've sort of changed a tad. 6 months ago, they were focused on fighting inflation. They've now surrendered. So they're now so scared that the economy will completely collapse that they're cutting rates like crazy and killing the savers of America. That's what. So I know what they say. I happen not to believe one word they say, but I do know. I hear what they say. As far as I'm concerned, it falls on deaf ears. We're already in a recession, and they may have a temporary good quarter by throwing all those checks out of helicopters that will, of course, explode the deficit and borrow the money from China. If they think that's smart, I have some words for them, but that's what they're going to do, and that's going to be a fix for like 3 months, and then that'll be over with.
Howard, where do you think we're headed here? How do we wring this problem out of the system?
Well, I think the only way you can wring the problem out of the system is with tremendous pain, and politicians are not good about on that. We need a very severe recession. We're going to have one anyway. And how did we? You got to go back and say, how did we get into this? I mean, Alan Greenspan cut rates. He created an environment where we had this mad rush for housing, where everybody was buying a house. George Bush said when he ran, that was one of the centerpieces of his policy, that more and more people should buy homes. Of course, there was a little detail. They couldn't afford it, but why get interfered with the detail? So the point is that we got into this. We got into this by making credit too loose, by having no regulation, and by running wild.
You know, recession doesn't...
fixing it the same way.
Yeah, recession doesn't necessarily sound so bad. We've seen some pretty mild ones in recent years. Is that what you're talking about or something else?
Oh, no, I'm talking about a very... We're going to have a very severe recession. I mean, really severe. Now, it's either going to happen now or 2 years from now. You can't solve our problems without a severe restructuring. And what I mean is the government can't bail everybody out because the government doesn't have any money. Whenever we spend money, we have to borrow it from China. We don't have any money. So we need a severe restructuring of what we've been doing. That's going to mean a lot of pain. It's going to mean unemployment, 8-9%. It's going to happen anyway.
Howard Davidovits, we're not going to call you Little Miss Sunshine. That's a dark view, but you put it vividly, and we appreciate you laying it out for us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us.
Have a good day.
You too. Howard Davidovits, retail analyst, chairman of Davidovits and Associates. Joining me now from Bethesda, Maryland, Robert Samuelson, columnist for Newsweek magazine and The Washington Post. Robert Samuelson, thanks very much for being here.
Hi.
Hi. We've read you this week saying people are talking about stagflation. It's too early for that. That's not what we've got going on here. It's not the 70s redux. But where are we? You know, ordinary people are hearing all kinds of scary headlines flying around, and the intimation that this may not even be the kind of recession we've known, but something worse. Is that a legitimate fear at this point, Mr. Samuelson?
Well, I think it's a legitimate fear to think that we'll have a severe recession. I don't know whether we will or we won't. The commentary that you got from your previous speaker, I think most of his facts are right. Whether or not it will be as whether or not we will actually have a recession and it will be as deep and as protracted as he expects, I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. We have to remember, however, that although the economy is slowing down, unemployment now is 4.9%. Mm. The average over the last 50 years is 5.6%. Right now, we're not in a catastrophic situation. The only part of the economy that is extremely weak, and I would say in a disastrous shape, is the housing sector.
Banking?
And it's certainly true that we went overboard in housing, and prices got too high, and now we're suffering the consequences.
Mm. What do you see unfolding here? You talk about the bind that the Fed is in now in terms of addressing this situation.
Well, the bind the Fed is in is really classic. On the one hand, they don't want a recession, or if they have a recession, they want it to be as mild as possible. So for those reasons, you want to ease credit. And they've been easing credit now since August. Their overnight Fed funds rate has come down from 5.25% to 3%, and most people who watch this think it will come down further. On the other hand, they don't want to let inflation get out of hand, and it seems to be verging. They're on the edge of that. Last year, inflation was up a little bit over 4%. If you take out energy prices, which exploded, the increase was like 2.5%. But more worrisome is what's been happening in the last three or four months.
January wholesale inflation 7.5% up over the last 12
months. Wholesale inflation year over year was over 7%. If you look at consumer prices in the last 3 months, the annual rate of increase was 6.8%. If you take out energy prices, again, it was 3.5%. So clearly something is happening with inflation. And if you want to keep inflation down, you don't want to ease credit and money too much. So they're facing this classic dilemma of what to do. And the point I have made is that even if we have a recession, recessions are unpleasant, but they do have some good effects. And one of the good effects is to keep inflation under control and prevent it from getting so high that ultimately you have to have a very, very, very stiff and painful recession to get it back under control.
Are we in that situation now? Howard DeVilliers says this is going to be a tougher recession than most Americans may have ever known.
Well, I would probably disagree. In the early 1980s, as a result of the high inflation that developed in the 1970s when it got up well over 10% and peaked at more than 13%, we had to have, and we did have, a really harsh recession when unemployment reached almost 11% at its peak.
Mortgage rates 18%.
I don't think we're going there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the economy, all the bad news piling up, and just how low this could go. Robert Samuelson has joined us, columnist for Newsweek magazine and The Washington Post. He says, hold on a minute. We don't see 1970s stagflation out there right now. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke testifying before the House Financial Services Committee yesterday. Here he's describing the challenges the economy is facing and where he sees the risk.
The risks to this outlook remain to the downside. Those risks include the possibilities that the housing market or the labor market may deteriorate more than is currently anticipated, and that credit conditions may tighten substantially further.
Housing market, credit, labor, all risk factors, says Ben Bernanke. Robert Samuelson's with us from Bethesda, Maryland. We're joined right now as well from Berkeley, California, by Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. He's now professor of public policy at UC Berkeley, author of Super Capitalism, The Transformation of Business, Democracy, and Everyday Life. Robert Reich, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you.
Hi, Tom.
We've got the sense that people are looking at all these headlines and wondering, holy smokes, is this not just maybe a recession? We've seen those come and go. But is there something worse here? You know, are the wise guys preparing for something that us ordinary folk haven't even contemplated yet?
Well, I think it's pretty fundamental. It is, in a sense, a perfect storm because, as Howard Davidovits was saying, you've got food and energy prices soaring right now. That is a tremendous imposition on consumers. Meanwhile, credit markets are still very frozen, which means that even though the Fed has reduced interest rates, mortgage rates are not dropping. They're actually, in many places around the country, they're increasing. And meanwhile, housing prices are going down. And that's been the consumer piggy bank for years as consumers have refinanced and got all sorts of money out of their houses in order to maintain their buying. So remember, consumers are the energizer bunnies of the economy. If consumers don't have any more money, if they're deep in debt, if they are really in trouble, as most of us as consumers are, people are going to pull back from the malls and pull back from buying. And that's going to mean that there's just not enough buying power out there to keep the economy going. You know, Tom, it's sort of like a day of reckoning because as those housing prices went up, over the last 4 or 5 years, as consumers started to, borrow more and more money to keep themselves going and go deeper and deeper into debt, well, eventually, you know, you're going to come to some big, you know, explosion. And I don't want to say it's going to be anything worse than a recession, but I agree with Howard and also with Robert Samuelson.
Well, put it in some historical context for us. Bob Samuelson reminds us in his recent column that 1969 to 1982, that's a long time, we had 7.5% average inflation annually, unemployment 6.4%. Those are numbers like, you know, Americans under, I don't know what, 40 or much more have really never experienced as working adults. Are we in for something new for most people?
We've had a very good run, and a lot of that good run, you might say, has been a little bit artificial. It's been masked in a way. That is, median wages, the wage of the person smack in the middle, if you adjust for inflation, the real cost of buying everything, Tom, median wages have not increased very much. Most of the money that has been generated by this growing economy has gone to people at the top. People in the very middle haven't done very well. People below them have done less well. And so what have they done to keep themselves going? Well, women went to work. I wish I could say it was because of all these professional opportunities for women. But most women went to work starting in the 1970s because they had to prop up family incomes. And then people worked longer hours. The average American today is working about 350 hours a year longer than the average European. And then you went into all this borrowing binge in order to keep people afloat. But the fact of the matter is that most people have been living beyond their paychecks. And eventually, you just can't do that. And when you do reach the day of reckoning, and we may have reached the day of reckoning now, you're going to have a recession or worse. Now, I've heard Robert Samuelson and also Howard Davidovits say, well, maybe we have to have a recession. Maybe that's good. And I can understand in economic and financial terms, you do have to sometimes have a recession to kind of flush the system clean. But there's a lot of human suffering in a recession or worse, a deep recession. People are losing their homes already. The estimates are that 2 million homeowners may lose their homes. A lot of people are in danger of losing their jobs. A lot of people are very deep in debt. The bankruptcy laws are certainly not conducive to people reorganizing their debts these days. You've got a lot of potential suffering on Main Street, even though Wall Street is in a state of alarm. Main Street is really in potentially very, very serious difficulty.
Robert Samuelson, you write that trying to prevent a recession at this point at all costs is a fool's errand. Bob Reich says day of reckoning perhaps here. So is Ben Bernanke wrong to try and head off a recession now? And if we need that sort of, in your view, cleansing breath of a recession, how deep a recession to work out what seem like quite enormous structural problems?
Well, I don't know. The point I was trying to make is if you pump in too much money and too much credit into the system, ultimately you don't avoid a recession. You may postpone it, but it's worse because you, in the process, you've aggravated inflation. And the figures you cited earlier about the high inflation and this simultaneous high unemployment of the 1970s was what resulted from precisely that kind of process. The Fed engaged in a series of kind of stop-go policies where inflation would get too high, would sort of try to stop the economy temporarily to get it under control. Then it would get worried that the economy was going into too deep a recession, pump out all this money and credit, and inflation would go yet higher. And so the next recession was, in fact, worse than the preceding recession. And ultimately, that culminated with a really draconian recession of the early 1980s when, as I said before, unemployment got almost to 11%. So we certainly don't want to go down that path, and I'm a little bit worried that the Fed may be veering in that direction.
But when we see the scale,
I
just wanted to ask, when we see the scale of everything today, the scale of debt, the scale of the trade imbalances.
It's true that the scale of debt, consumer debt, the last time I looked, which was a couple of months ago, was roughly 135% of disposable income, so that the typical family had more debt than its annual income. If you go back to the end of the World War II, that comparable figure was 22%. So we have been, for the last half century, consistently increasing consumer debt, and that's included in mortgages. And most of that has actually been a good thing. It's enabled people to buy homes. The home ownership rate has gone up. Before World War II, was about 44%. Now it's 68 or 69%. So it's not an all bad thing. And what, to some extent, has offset the rise in absolute debt has been the decline in interest rates over the last 20 or 25 years as inflation has come down. So the debt burden, that is to say interest payments and principal payments as a proportion of income, have not gone up nearly as dramatically as the overall debt levels have gone up.
But what depth of recession? I mean, you're writing that sometimes recessions are necessary. As Bob Reich says, that comes with pain. I think people may look out at the scale of some of the structural problems we're facing and wonder if this is sort of some sort of epic reckoning that we're looking at now or familiar.
The answer is I don't know. I'm not that smart, and I don't think anybody else is that smart. But let me just point out some things that may cushion it. I mean, everybody has talked over the last two or three years about how Americans have gone on a kind of shopping spree. We've been over-consuming, under-saving, buying too much, and to some extent that's true. And there's a need to shift the emphasis of the economy towards more savings, lower imports. We have these huge trade deficits. And that process could cushion a recession as you get increased exports substituting for imports, and you get a declining trade deficit, and the trade deficit is beginning to go down now. And you get higher savings and more investment in export-oriented industries. That's the kind of structural change that we should welcome. And to the extent that it occurs, it will cushion the weaker spending on housing and the weaker spending, consumer spending. But it's not, these kind of transitions are not painless, as Secretary Wright points out. You know, people lose their jobs. You know, there are setbacks, but you know, we have to try to keep these things in perspective. And one of the things that, you know, I think we've learned in the last 20 or 25 years is that if we maintain low inflation, that this economy is enormously resilient.
Mm-hmm.
And new sources of demand do develop, even, you know, against people's expectations.
Yep.
We do create new industries, and that's the underlying dynamic that has kept the economy going forward. Mm. And so I don't think we ought to completely dismiss this underlying resilience that the economy has shown over, as I say, over the last 20 or 25 years.
We're just looking to be eyes wide open here. And Bob Reich, I want to ask you on that the front of that cushion, the sort of countervailing forces that may cushion some of this. Let me get a caller or two here, in, if I may, first from Marshalltown, Iowa. Sally, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
There's so much to say, I'm not even sure where to start. But I'm a college professor. I teach environmental biology. We are not big consumers. We have had lack of health insurance and health issues in our family for the last decade and have had to use credit cards to help pay for costs.
Yep.
We cannot save. My salary goes up every year, and we can't save any money.
What about prices, Sally?
Excuse me?
Prices. Are you seeing prices go up?
Absolutely. I go to the grocery store. I would say 15 to 20%. My bills are going up already. Our energy, our fuel for our home this winter, we're already 30% over what we paid last year. I can't keep up with it. And we haven't been able to save money for a decade because every time we get a little bit ahead, we have to pay for, you know, cars go up, house maintenance goes up, medical care costs. I have good health insurance through the community college where I teach. And it's covering less and less every year. I took my kids for immunizations. It cost us $380 last year for three immunizations.
And when you look forward, do you see things looking up or looking dark?
I do not. I am very, very, very concerned. And, you know, I'd like to consider myself upper middle class, but I've probably spent most of the last decade close to poverty level or below. I mean, there are times when I have had to, you know, get free immunizations and things like that because we couldn't afford it. And now I'm at a point where I make enough money, I can't afford, I don't qualify for help.
Sally, thanks very much for that first-hand report. Let me throw it to Robert Reich. Here's the story, Bob, and we're not in recession at this point, we're told. But Sally's feeling kind of up against it already. If we're headed down, what does that mean for families like hers?
Well, Tom, we are in recession as far as families like Sally's is concerned. And remember, Sally said she'd never thought that she was in poverty, certainly didn't feel like she was lower, even lower middle class. She thought she was upper middle class. Mm. And yet medical bills and everything else are amassing, and it's very hard to afford just what she and her family need. And I hear that over and over again across the country. I mean, here's the irony. The country as an economy is bigger and bigger and bigger. We are a much larger economy than we were 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. And yet much of that growth has gone not to average working people, people in the middle, people lower than the middle, working class people we used to call them. Much of the growth has gone to people at the very top. Now, the problem is, apart from issues of social inequity, there's also a problem of buying power. Because if most of the or a very, very large portion of economic growth finds its way to the top and not to the middle or lower middle, you know, who's going to actually do the buying? The people in the middle and lower middle and working class people are the ones who are most apt to spend their paychecks. People at the top are going to save their paychecks or they're going to put them into maybe invest them around the world wherever they can get the highest return.
But you can only buy so many yachts, I guess.
Well, I think to some extent, Tom, I think, again, part of this day of reckoning is that we can no longer mask what's been going on in this country in terms of widening inequity and concentration of wealth at the top.
Let me take a call from Charles in Bennington, Vermont. Charles, are you there, my friend?
You know, Tom, I really feel that we have recession, we have it big, and it's getting worse. The Fed is acting, in my point of view, like a modern-day sorcerer's apprentice. It really doesn't know what it's doing. You reduce the rate of interest, you're only going to encourage speculation and uncontrolled spending. And that's exactly what got us into this mess in the first place. You can bet on it. Inflation's going to soar as well. I really think that we have to look at strengthening the value of the dollar, encouraging domestic savings, and for God's sakes, decreasing our debt and deficit, as well as looking at defense spending. That's grotesque and should be cut down.
Charles, that's a great big agenda, but let us pick a piece of it. Bob Samuelson, take the dollar for a moment. Charles says we've got to strengthen the dollar, but can we or do we? Does it have to be low in order to keep those the hope of greater exports out there and turning around those trade imbalances?
Well, a lower dollar does help our exports. You certainly don't want the dollar to go into a free fall. And I think that part of the problem is that all the pressure on the dollar has, or much of the pressure on the dollar has played out against the euro because China and some other Asian countries effectively have fixed their exchange rates and are frustrating or preventing their currencies from going up, which they should go up since they have massive trade surpluses. And so that is one of the structural problems that exists in the world. We've been trying to persuade them to let their currency rise more rapidly than they have. We've been mostly unsuccessful in this, but that's a problem, it seems to me. But that's not something that we can unilaterally cure. And to the extent that people want to bail out of the dollar, they bail into the euro, and that's why the euro has been going up as rapidly as it has been. And at some point, that will probably hurt the European economy by depressing their exports, because their exports will become more expensive. And that on the whole, will not be good for the world economy. So that is a problem, but it's not entirely an American problem.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the economy and all the bad news we've seen piling up in the headlines. Former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich is with us, now professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is Super Capitalism. And from Bethesda, Maryland, Robert Samuelson joins us, columnist for Newsweek magazine and The Washington Post. Right now, let's go to Ben in Cabot, Vermont. Hi, Ben. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I hear an awful lot of talk about inflation, and obviously we're seeing sort of inflationary pressures on commodity prices in particular. But, the classic definition of deflation is a decrease in money supply. And to the extent that, you know, for many years we've been using credit as money, I'm really interested to hear your guests talk about how, is there any way to view the current credit crisis as potentially deflationary? And could we start to see some of that pass through in pricing? I mean, obviously, the housing market You know, we are seeing deflating prices. I mean, there's two definitions of deflation, both, you know, in a decrease in money supply and then a decrease in prices.
But deflation seeing, because the banks aren't pumping out as much money, and so might things turn around and go down?
Exactly, and we're seeing, you know, housing prices crash. So we're seeing deflation, from my view, and admittedly it's not as educated a view as your guest, but it occurs to me that what we're seeing is the classic, you know, Austrian definition of deflation in a contracting money supply, but also deflationary pricing in housing. And I just don't hear anyone talking about this.
Let us look at it, Ben. Robert Reich, is that part of what Ben Bernanke seems to be counting on, thinking he can both cut interest rates to try and spur growth, but not fear inflation so much because you've got this bigger context that's going to hold it down, including falling home prices, Bob?
Well, Bernanke is on the horns of a terrible dilemma. And obviously, he is counting on the fact that reducing short-term interest rates is going to make it easier for people to continue to borrow and perhaps have an effect on mortgage rates going down. One of the things, though, that's lurking in the shadows that we haven't talked about, and it is a beast lurking in the shadows, and that is global demand, China and India. One reason that energy prices are going up, even though Americans are getting nervous, can't quite afford to do what they were doing before, is that China and India have such huge, huge appetites for oil and for world energy and even food. I mean, one of the reasons that food prices are going up, food is also a global commodity now. Corn is a global commodity. Soybeans, a global commodity. Ethanol in the United States means that there is less foodstuff, non-ethanol foodstuff to go around. That's going to put a kind of upward pressure on food prices. So in a global market, there's a limited amount that a particular central banker can do.
Robert Samuelson, on our caller Ben's question about deflation, the inflation danger we see, and we read about inflation now in China as well, but Ben looks at falling home prices and wonders, at some point, is there a deflation risk? Can those ride so closely one next to the other, Bob Samuelson?
Well, if there's a collapse in buying around the world, you might get deflation. Or before we got deflation, we would get disinflation, which is just a lowering of the rate of inflation. But and it's possible. But it would really presume that economies around the world not only slowed down, but really kind of collapsed. And I suppose that's conceivable, but we don't see the signs of it yet. What you do see is that, you know, we have rising inflation in China, we have rising inflation in the United States, and to some extent, the cure for that will be slowdowns in these economies. But it would take a really profound slowdown, and a drop in economic production, a large rise in unemployment, to get the kind of collapse in overall buying, it seems to me, that would result in an across-the-board decline in prices. Now, if you do get a slowdown, you probably will get some decline in commodity prices, food prices, energy prices, minerals, and other raw materials. And that would be a good thing because these prices have gone up dramatically in the last year or so. But in terms of overall deflation, you know, it's a theoretical possibility, but right now I don't see it, and neither does anybody else. Most observers don't see it.
Let's go to Putney, Vermont, and Nancy. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hello. I have a question. I'm not a trained economist at all, but this is something that I've thought about might be happening, which is that George W. Bush and the Republicans are really trying to save their hides in this next election, and it seems possible that they keep on lowering interest rates because they're trying to stave off an incredibly serious recession. And I guess this inflation where wage earners are earning less is much more subtle than a huge, tremendous crash. But it just feels too timely that there's only a short time until the election and the Republicans are really dying to not be nailed with the party that completely destroyed the economy.
Nancy, let us pick it up. Bob Reich, inquiring voter, wants to know, you know, could the Fed be risking inflation by lowering rates now for political reasons?
No, I don't think the Fed is doing that. There's very little evidence that the Fed could, would, has in the past played that kind of a political game, Nancy. In fact, if anything, if you look historically, the Fed of Paul Volcker put an end to Jimmy Carter's presidency essentially by breaking the back of inflation, yanking interest rates up. The Fed of Alan Greenspan, well, it was very, very tough on the first George Bush. Some people say that that's why we went into recession and George Bush lost to Bill Clinton. No, I think that the Republicans right now are very fearful, not because of what the Fed may or may not do, but because the economy is, for all the reasons we've been talking about, going into something of a tailspin. The perfect storm, whether it happens in 2008, kind of a middle summer, or it happens in the fall, or some economists would say that it's already started. We don't know often when recessions begin until the data come in and we look back and say, oh, well, the recession did start then. I think my political reading is that many Americans are just saying, well, we're in very tough shape, and accurately or not, are blaming the current administration.
Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, author of Super Capitalism. Bob Reich, always great to hear from you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Robert Samuelson, last word goes to you here. Do you see politics playing into our economic fate right now, one way or another, or not?
Well, I think it is, but I tend to agree with Secretary Reich in this sense. The pressure to sort of pump up the economy has come from both Republicans and Democrats. I agree with the caller that if the economy deteriorates, the Republicans will probably suffer politically because they occupy the White House, and I think voters just tend to blame whichever party is in the White House when the economy goes sour. But the pressures to reduce interest rates, the pressures to have a stimulus program have been completely bipartisan, and Democrats want to show that they care about ordinary people. Republicans want to show they care about ordinary people. I think the Fed has relaxed less as a result of the political pressures than as a result of financial pressures. They have seen what is going on. Banks and investment banks have suffered large losses from subprime mortgages particularly, and the Fed is fearing that they will cut back on their lending and that will worsen the economy. And so the Fed has tried to offset those pressures by reducing interest rates and easing credit on its own, hoping that more money and credit out there will induce and influence banks and investment banks to continue investing and lending on their own. So I think that's the main pressure on the Fed right now and not the political pressure.
Well, you wouldn't wish this moment on the Fed or, for that matter, on the economy, but here we are. Robert Samuelson, you help us understand it, and we're grateful for that. Thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
Robert Samuelson, columnist for Newsweek and The Washington Post. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, we'll look back and remember William F. Buckley, Jr., who died yesterday at 82. This is On Point. William F. Buckley, Jr., one of the fathers, many say the father of modern conservatism, died yesterday at 82, at his desk in his study. Buckley founded the Conservative National Review in 1955 and was host of the long-running TV show Firing Line. He was a public intellectual whose sharp wit and inimitable elocution made him a household name in American politics. Here he is with us in 2002 offering his conservative answer to liberalism.
Well, the conservative answer is you're doing it not only the wrong way, what you're doing is hurting.
Joining us now from Washington to talk about Buckley and his legacy is David Keene, president of the American Conservative Union. David, thanks very much for being with us today.
It's a real pleasure.
Place this man in the modern conservative pantheon, his role, his impact.
There is no one, or was no one, who was more important to the development of modern conservatism than Bill Buckley. It all started, in a sense, with founding of National Review in 1955. He had earlier published a book, God and Man, at Yale in 1951. But at National Review, he brought together the disparate elements of what was to become the modern conservative movement. and provided a sort of incubator in which they were able to debate and bond and create something that hadn't existed before. You have to remember that during the in the 50s, the general intellectual attitude in the United States was that there was no American conservative tradition and no respectable conservative political or philosophical movement, a position taken by public intellectuals of the time like Lionel Trilling. Buckley changed that within a very few years, and the amazing thing about him is that he took these ideas through a magazine, put them together, and then went out and publicized them. We think about National Review, but Firing Line was the longest-running public affairs program in the history of broadcast television. He published thousands upon thousands of columns. He wrote 40 or 50 books on everything from travel to novels to books on conservatism, and at the same time made 50 or 60 speeches a year in front of college audiences and just about anybody else he could talk to. He was a one-man dynamo, and he gave the spark that resulted ultimately in the election, the nomination of Goldwater in 64 and the election of Reagan in 80.
Let's hear just a little bit of that Buckley touch. He would luxuriate in heated debates with guests on fine intellectual points. Here's a famous show from Firing Line, 1969, Buckley and liberal thinker and writer Noam Chomsky.
It is also true, and I think manifestly true, there have been interferences with the affairs of other nations whose purposes were, in my judgment, manifestly benign.
For example?
Well, for instance, the Truman Doctrine.
Oh, I don't think that was manifestly benign at all. That was an attempt to
well, the Greeks
develop an
organ. I think
the Greek situation was benign, not at all. We were
I say
to
the Greeks' testimony is more interesting to me than yours.
Which Greek testimony?
The testimony of the
thousands of people who were thrown into jail and...
I grant not the testimony of the Greek communists who were beaten.
Or the Greek peasants who were...
There again, is it a conceptual difference that between the person who desires a life under some kind of freedom and one who desires life under some kind of
was
under communism?
Buckley and Chomsky in 1969. By 2006, he was feeling a little down at the mouth about the conservative movement. I want to ask you about that, David Keene. Here he is in May 06 talking with Charlie Rose, saying the conservative movement, to his view, had lost some of its vigor.
There's a certain sleepiness in the conservative movement. Now, this doesn't mean that original ideas shouldn't be championed, and they should be begot. And we have the National Review all the time, but they seem kind of trifling up against the general sense of satisfaction that's so widely felt.
David Keene, I have to ask you, we've heard a lot of kind of lauding of William F. Buckley Jr. in the last 24 hours since news of his death emerged. At the same time, here we are, we're deep in a war that he himself was critical of. We've just spent most of this hour talking about an economy that seems in deep trouble, and this at the end of a period, perhaps even beyond a period of conservative ascendancy. For you, as head of the American Conservative Union, is it a bittersweet moment to look back on to celebrate Bill Buckley's life?
Well, I think Bill would say, as would I, that the problems we face today are precisely the result of deviation from the principles that he articulated and held to throughout his career. What was reflected a bit in that interview was his sadness, if you will, at the careerism and political opportunism of people who got into politics initially motivated by principle and a desire to change the world for the better. That wasn't true of everybody, but Bill was a man who was not at heart a politician, though Lord knows he influenced a generation of politicians. He was a man who was dedicated to ideas. He loved debate, as in your previous soundbite, and he was never closed to the world around him. So even by 2006, of course, he'd largely retired. Mm. He believed that the Iraqi invasion, in retrospect, as he said, was a violation of conservative principle rather than a continuation of it, and that many conservatives in power in Congress and elsewhere had replaced principle with what they saw as political opportunism.
Did you ever worry, or do you, that what the problems we're facing right now might be the culmination of, rather than deviation from, the high concepts that he articulated so marvelously.
On the political side, that's precisely what Bill was talking about. I used to say that you can tell that a movement born of ideas is beginning to be successful when the rats join the ship. The success, the early success from an intellectual standpoint of the movement, was not just that Bill Buckley and those he gathered around him at National Review debated and developed the ideas that underpinned the later political movement, but that he nurtured and socialized a generation of people into those ideas. As it became successful, people joined the movement and described themselves as conservatives for political advantage rather than moving in the other direction. And I think that's true of the maturation, if you will, of all movements.
David Keene, we'll talk about it again. We're grateful to you for being with us today from the American Conservative Union. William F. Buckley, Jr., dead yesterday at 82. This is On Point.